From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. With the economy still slumping, the Bush administration is barreling ahead with a whopping $300 billion economic stimulus package that will very soon be before Congress. Tax cuts are at the top of the White House stimulation agenda, along with business incentives for spurring productivity, growth, and perhaps George W.'s re-election bid. Is this the right prescription to boost an ailing economy, or might the cure hurt more than it helps? In this hour, the Bush Economic Fix. We begin with the latest on the emerging stimulus package. Final elements of the plan are being hammered out by the president's new economic team, led by Treasury Secretary nominee John Snow. Jonathan Wiseman is economic policy reporter for The Washington Post. I asked him about the timing of the administration's announcement of the new stimulus package.
Well, they actually wanted to do it next week or even this week, but given the unpleasantness of last week.
That is the unpleasantness of replacing top economic advisors.
Yes, exactly. They need to get it done and rolled out in early January because they're going to be rolling out their 2004 budget in January, too. You know, there's always tons of news that comes out with the budget. They always do their kind of leak-a-day thing to give us little previews, and they don't want those little budget issues to swamp the rollout of the stimulus package. So it's coming soon.
Coming soon. What are the major elements of the stimulus plan that the Bush White House is likely to push through Congress or try to?
This package is going to be heavily tilted to investors and investment. For the consumer side, they will almost certainly try to accelerate tax rate cuts that were part of the big tax cut last year, and rate cuts that were scheduled for 2004 would be pushed to 2003, so workers would get a little bit more money in their paychecks as soon as possible. On the investment side, they will add some kind of bonus depreciation allowance, i.e. some kind of added write-off for businesses who invest in new plant and equipment.
They can write that down more quickly.
Mm-hmm. They will almost certainly dramatically cut, if not eliminate, the tax on dividend income from stock. And they'll increase the amount of money that can be deducted for stock losses from your taxes. On savings issues, they will almost certainly expand the contribution limits to IRAs and 401ks.
Mm-hmm.
They will raise the mandatory withdrawal age for IRAs. Right now, you have to start withdrawing from your IRA at 70 and a half.
Even if you're not ready and don't want to just then, right?
Exactly. So they hope to raise that to 75. And they may do a few more things on investment and retirement savings. They've told Senate aides they're shooting for about $100 billion in the first year or two because they figured that's what they need to really stimulate the economy.
So $300 billion over 10 years. Paul O'Neill was saying before his recent and sudden departure that the economy was recovering. Does the economy still need this stimulus plan?
Well, that's a good question. And if you ask economists, most of them seem to say no. They seem to think that by the time the administration rolls it out, the Congress takes a good look, they get their digs in, it finally gets through Congress and gets signed, the recovery will be well underway and the timing of this will not be particularly auspicious.
So why the big push by the Bush administration now?
Because the Bush administration actually, they don't even call this a stimulus package. They call it a growth package. They don't particularly care whether or not the economy is out of recession. What they want to do is really kick it into high gear and get things rolling fast enough so that voters will feel better by 2004 when the president is up for re-election. They're very focused right now on political issues. They also want to look like they are actively doing something about the economy. They don't want to repeat the mistakes of the president's father, who was perceived rightly or wrongly in 1992 as not particularly caring about the economy.
Jonathan Wiseman, you said at the outset that this package is focused primarily on investment and investors. Why? What's the operating philosophy here?
The operating philosophy is that, well, you can basically do two things with tax packages. You can try to do a consumer tax package, get money into the hands of consumers so they can go out and spend and prime the pump that way. Or you could focus on investment and get businesses to invest and individuals to invest and get businesses running that way. And right now, they're looking at the numbers, and they see that consumer spending, although in a bit of a lag, has held up pretty well. There doesn't seem to be the big issue of consumer spending right now. Actually, there's been a big drop in car sales and some of the big ticket items. But so far, sales look pretty good for the holiday season. The big problem with the economy right now is business investment. Business investment is not doing well. It has not done well for a year. Congress actually did pass a investment tax package earlier this year. Nobody says it did anything. The question is whether or not a second round will do anything.
Presumably, Democrats will portray this as more tax cuts for the rich. What are the prospects for the stimulus package in Congress?
I actually think the prospects are extremely good. I think something will pass. In fact, the administration is kind of taking an interesting tack. They're going to have their preferred stuff. They're going to load it down on the investment side because that's where they think. But they are willing to entertain ideas from the Democrats who are pushing more consumer tax cuts. Everybody is talking about some kind of stimulus package. You know, if you talk to them off the record, they might say this isn't necessarily necessary, but they're not going to look like they're the ones sitting on the sideline. I think something is going to pass, and I think the Democrats want to pass something. And remember, Congress is completely controlled by Republicans right now.
And what about the national deficit? Tax cuts presumably mean a larger deficit, at least in the short run. Is anyone worrying about that?
Look, we had the largest swing from surplus to deficit virtually this century, this year, and it had no resonance whatsoever on the campaign trail. Politically, there's no fear of deficits.
But as you've written, the new Treasury Secretary, John Snow, has been very hard on deficits, very opposed to deficits through the 90s. Can he now turn around and sing this song for President Bush that deficits don't matter?
Well, he won't sing that song because what they like to say at the White House is that deficits do matter. We just have other priorities right now, and our priorities are the war on terrorism, defending our country, and getting the economy rolling. But in the long run, we'll get concerned about deficits. We're just not worried about it in the short run. The mantra from the White House is economic growth creates surpluses, not the other way around. Surpluses don't create economic growth. And therefore, if we are pushing economic growth, we will eventually get surpluses. And Jon Snow will repeat that line very well. In fact, that's why Jon Snow is being brought on, because he is very good at being a team player and repeating the administration's line.
Jonathan Weisman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Jonathan Weisman is a reporter with The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier from Washington. The firing of Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill and Economic Advisor Lawrence Lindsay on Friday were a White House signal that the Bush administration is ready to make a fresh noise on the economic front. Are these proposed tax cuts and business incentives just the right medicine to spur economic growth? Is the stimulus plan fair? Is it overkill right now? Is it re-election insurance at the price of major deficits? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Stephen Moore, the president of the Club for Economic Growth and a senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Moore.
Hi, Tom.
Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Also with us tonight from New York is On Point News analyst Amity Schlaes, senior columnist for the Financial Times. Hello, Amity.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Thanks for being with us, Amity. Stephen Moore, you've written that the changes at the top in terms of economic policy in the Bush administration last week were not just a kind of merry-go-round, but a real indication of policy change underway as we head toward an economic stimulus package. What's the change you see?
Well, I think that President Bush had lost confidence in his economics team. You know, his economics team for the last year and a half has been telling the president that the economy will be just fine and there's no need for a stimulus. We're going to have a lot of new job creation. We're going to have business profits. They were saying this for many, many months. And I think President Bush lost some confidence in them. And with Paul O'Neill, who I got to know and I think is a great man, but I think the problem was that Paul O'Neill from the start was always kind of a round plug that we were trying to, hammer into a square hole, and he never really fit in with the Bush team. So the idea here is to bring in a new team that will sell the program, because George W. Bush pretty much knows what the program is that he wants to sell. He does want to do a $300 billion tax cut, as Jonathan Weisman talked about. He wants it to be oriented towards investors. He wants to do something maybe about the capital gains tax and dividends taxes. He wants to speed up his own tax cut that passed a year and a half ago, 70% of which hasn't even seen the light of day yet. So what he needs and he hopes to get from this new economics team is a number of spokesmen who can go out on TV and on radio and in the hinterlands and sell this message.
Stephen Moore, so many questions arise here. I guess, first of all, is this stimulus package more about economic stimulus or more about George Bush bringing his political views, his ideology, to bear on the structure of the American economy?
I think it's both. I think he is a true believer, as I am, that when you put in place supply-side tax rate reductions, it can stimulate growth. And we have experience from the 1960s with the JFK tax cuts and the 1980s with the Kennedy tax cuts and then the last capital gains tax cut we did in the 1997 that indicate that theory is true, that you do get more growth when you cut tax rates. But I think also there's politics here. I think President Bush understands that he does not want to repeat the mistakes of his father, who lost to Bill Clinton because he neglected the economy. He seemed to be insensitive to the needs of workers. And by the time he got the economy turned around, Bill Clinton was in office.
And what about the deficits that we saw last time we plunged into supply-side economics? Are we flirting with that again? Does it suddenly not matter? The 90s are over. We need deficits now?
Well, I think my view of this, and Jonathan Weissman capsulized my view, and I think it's George W. Bush's view, is that obviously we have to be concerned about deficits, but deficits are more a symptom of the fact that the economy simply hasn't been growing fast enough to produce the jobs and the tax revenues to balance the budget, and that if we can get back to this 3 to 4 to 5% growth path that we had in the 80s and 90s, and if we can get back to full employment and put Americans back to work, that's the best way to get tax revenues in and to balance the budget. And so I think that especially when interest rates are so low right now, we don't need to be overly hypersensitive to deficits. We need to get Americans back to work, and we need to get companies making profits again. And finally, we need to get that economic growth rate back to up to a virtuous path of 4%, which I believe the American economy is very achievable in this economy.
And Stephen Moore, what about this? Daniel Altman, New York Times columnist writing in the Sunday Times, said Republicans in Congress and the White House are proposing changes to the income tax. And of course, tax cuts are at the heart of this plan. Mm-hmm. That could indeed lead to a more productive economy. He goes on, the resulting tax code could also be more slanted against the poor than at any time in history. And judging by the Republicans' record, there's not much hope that they will address those crushing side effects. You know that this is going to be part of the political debate over this package.
Sure.
Is it a fair observation?
Well, the fact of the matter is right now, when you look at the income tax, the top 10% of the earners in the country pay something like 60 to 65% of the income taxes. So if you want to do an income tax cut and you want to, you know, cut the rates, then the wealthy are going to get a big share of the tax cut. I would argue that the wealthy tend to be the investors. They tend to be the employers. They tend to be the risk takers. And without risk takers and employers, you're not going to have jobs. But I would make the additional point that the one area where I've been sort of pressing the administration to look at, in addition to these cuts in taxes for investors, is maybe it is time to do a cut in the payroll tax rate, maybe cut that rate from 15% to 13 or 14% to give all workers, all 135 million American workers, a decent-sized tax cut. Mm-hmm. And I'd be interested in what Amity Slays has to say about that.
Everybody wants to hear from Amity. What do you think? Amity, are you welcoming this economic stimulus plan? It's coming down the pike.
Absolutely. I think it's quite interesting they're calling it a growth package. That's good news, and I wonder if Steve would agree with that over the phrase stimulus.
Right.
Because stimulus is not necessarily the right word. In fact, when you look back in 2001 at the last stimulus package, there's a very interesting study out of the University of Michigan to see what people did with those famous rebate checks they got in the summer of 2001. And economist Joel Slemrod found that people did not spend them. So
what's the distinction you're drawing, Amity, between growth package and stimulus plan?
Well, in the long run, if you cut taxes and you make the environment more friendly for the investor, and the investor is important because he's the one who generates jobs, you will see overall growth and everyone will benefit. There will be more jobs, there will be more spending, all those other things will follow in train. So it's not bad to cut taxes, it's great, but to call it a stimulus, like you can micromanage it, is a crazy assumption.
Amity Schley, Stephen Moore, stand by, we've got to take a short break. We're talking about the Bush economic stimulus plan, you may call it the Bush growth package. What do you think? Does this economy need a kick in the pants from Washington? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush economic stimulus plan. They like to call it the growth package. We're talking about tax cuts, deficits, and ideology on the way in Washington. My guests tonight are Stephen Moore, president for the Club for Growth, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Amity Schley, our guest news analyst tonight, joining us from New York. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. The bulk of tax cuts are headed to the investor class. Does that include you? Is this trickle-down, supply-side redux, will it work? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. We're joined now from Washington by Dean Baker. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a liberal think tank in Washington. Good evening and welcome, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean, you've been listening in. You've been watching everything going on in Washington. You see what's coming down the pike. What do you make of it? Is this the path to growth?
Well, I think, you know, we're arguing stimulus package, growth package. I think it's just simply called the give more money to Bill Gates package, because that's what this administration is about, no matter what the problem is. They came into office, we had a big surplus. President Bush said, I'm here to give that back to the people. Suddenly the surplus is gone. We need stimulus, more money to the rich. You know, no matter what it is, this, no matter what the problem is, the answer is to give more money to the Bill Gates, the Ken Lays of the world. And President Bush has done that very well.
If that produces economic growth, do you have a problem with it?
There's no evidence for it. There's no evidence for it. We grew very rapidly in the 50s. You know what the marginal tax rate on rich people was in the 50s? 90%. You know what the corporate tax rate was in the 50s? 50%. That was the best growth. The 50s and 60s were the best growth ever. We had the highest marginal tax rates ever. You know, we heard Stephen, I got a kick out of this, risk takers. These people are risk takers. John Snow, our new Treasury Secretary, when he was CEO of CSX, borrowed $25 million from his company to buy the company's stock. Guess what? The stock did real poorly. What did he do? The company canceled the loan.
Risk-free.
Risk-free. These people aren't risk takers. They're thieves. You know, I'm just amazed. This isn't even ideology. This is just, we have people going out there with bags saying, give us all your money, and then they're kind of coming up with the justification after the fact.
We'll talk about politics, Dean Baker, but what's your solution? We are in a sluggish economy. It's not good for anybody right now. What would you do about
it? Well, let's have some real stimulus, and I'll give you know, we want to have some tax cuts or we don't want to see tax increases. State and local governments have cumulative deficits on the order of $60, $70, $80 billion a year. This has been widely reported. Mm-hmm. Most of them are under obligations, constitutional obligations. They have to balance the budget.
So they're cutting spending, raising taxes?
Exactly. They have to do that. That's going to slow the economy very immediately. We're seeing the layoff notices going out as we speak. So let's take some of the money. I don't mind running a large deficit. Stephen's right about that. When you're in a slump, fine, run a deficit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so let's get that money to the states and local governments so they don't have to lay off the teachers, lay off the police officers.
You're saying have the federal government assume some of their debt?
No. But revenue sharing. This goes back to Dick Nixon. I'm not talking about anything radical here. You know, we can do it very quickly, and it will prevent the layoffs, prevent the tax increases that I say they're going into place now all around the country.
Stephen Moore, what do you say? Dean Baker says this is just throwing more money at the rich who don't deserve it, and it doesn't make growth anyway, and it's not going to work. Your response?
Well, I think it's sort of the class warfare argument that the Democrats tried to use in the last election, and you know, all you hear from the liberals right now is just class warfare and class envy, and I don't think it's a very persuasive response to Americans, partly because I think when liberals talk about, well, you know, we don't want to cut taxes on the rich. In fact, we want to raise taxes on the rich. I think a lot of Americans, you know, who are making $40,000 or $50,000 or $60,000 or $70,000 a year are thinking that means they're coming after me. And so I think that's the reason that the class warfare argument doesn't work. But the fact is, we need to do more to get businesses investing. And, you know, there's an old rule in economics that when you tax something, you get less of it. And when you tax something less, you get more of it. And what I think Amity and I are suggesting is if we stop overtaxing work and if we stop overtaxing investment and we stop overtaxing things like capital gains, we're going to get more of these things, and that will create jobs for all Americans. The one thing I'd say on this issue of the states, you know, if you look at the best period for the states in their finances. Mm-hmm. It was in the 1980s and 1990s, not the 1970s when we had revenue sharing. In fact, the 70s was a terrible decade for the states. And what I've argued is if you really want to help the states, get the economy booming again, because when we had strong growth in the 80s and then we had strong growth in the 90s, states had more money than they knew what to do with. I mean, they had revenues coming in at 8, 9, 10%. In fact, they spent so much money in the 80s and 90s, that's exactly the reason they're in budget trouble now.
Big appetites got built. Dean Baker, how about it? Stephen Moore says this is just more old class warfare, mau-mauing. It doesn't bring us growth, and Americans won't buy it.
No. Well, what they won't mind buy is his ad hominem arguments, because I could call his moves class warfare, too. I don't quite understand this. If you want to give money to rich people, that's not class warfare. I mean, that money comes from somewhere. I don't know. Steve might know of a money tree.
Well, it is their money.
But excuse me, Steve. So the money comes from somewhere. So, you know, if you want to give that money to rich people, that's class warfare. That's not class warfare. But if I say, no, let's give a tax break, why don't we give the money to the states so they don't have to lay off teachers so that kids can go to school? We give the money to the states so they don't have to raise the sales tax, a very regressive tax. That's class warfare. That doesn't make sense. Now, if you want to say, when did states do well? States did well in the 60s. We had a much higher tax rate then. They did well in the 50s. We had a much higher tax rate then. They actually didn't do particularly poorly in the 70s. They did very poorly in the early 90s. So I'm not quite sure. Stephen's history isn't very good here. I'm all for making the economy grow, but the fact is his policies haven't done that. The 80s, if you look back over the post-war period, the 80s, the era of Ronald Reagan, were actually the worst growth of any decade in the post-war period. We had very good growth after Bill Clinton raised taxes. I wouldn't say that was the reason for it, but, you know, if we're doing crude correlations here, we had high taxes in the 50s, we had high taxes in the 60s, we had Bill Clinton raise taxes in the 90s. That was only the most rapid growth.
Amity Schles, come in here. You know that many people's antenna are way up these days about the distribution of income and wealth in America. Is that the issue here? Is that what we should be debating as we talk about getting back on a growth track?
Well, I wish we weren't debating it, but I have a sense we will be, because that's how the fight's going to break out come January. Just a couple of facts. The bottom 50% of earners in income tax, what share of the income tax do they pay? They pay 4% of the income tax. They pay a lot of Social Security. Every worker pays Social Security. But the bottom 50% of households pay only 4%.
Is that because their income is so pathetic, Amity?
No, that is not. That's because we have phased out the income tax for lower earners in a bid to be fair and to help society. We've been through this debate over the past 20 years over and over again and created tax breaks for lower earners because we want to help them, because we want to offset Social Security for any number of reasons. And I want to ask a question here, which is it socially correct and right, is it civic to have the bottom 50% of households not participating, which is where we are already in the income tax obligation? We all talk about how we should do jury duty. We should get a driver's license. It's a little bit strange to have institutionalized class warfare where you have half the households not paying income tax. And then you have, as our guest Steve pointed out, an increasingly heavy burden for top earners. All right, they can afford a lot because they're doing well, but still the change is dramatic. You go back to 1980, top 1% of households carried 10% of the burden, or 9.3. It was real progressive. Wow. 10 times, but still only 10% of the tax burden. Now, that same group, top 1%, carries 37-36% of all the taxes. The tax code has become far more progressive than it was 20 years ago. Is that civic? Is it fair? That's what we should
Dean Baker, let me throw it to you. Is it civic? Is it fair for, I guess, as Amity has it, the bottom 50%?
I wonder what country Amity's been around, because here we've seen, you know, the Ken Lays of the world stealing hundreds of millions of dollars, and we're arguing over whether it's fair that we have a worker earning, you know, $6.50 an hour, and they're not paying taxes, income taxes, excuse me. They're paying payroll taxes, which Amity doesn't think are taxes. I think most people think they're taxes. They pay sales taxes. They're paying property taxes either through their rent or through owning. But they don't pay one tax, and she's concerned about that. I mean, this is a bizarre conversation. I mean, I want to see all of these people, Ken Lay and all those people, pay fines and probably be in jail for stealing hundreds of millions of dollars. And you're concerned we have someone who's working at the McDonald's at the minimum wage, $5.25 an hour, and they didn't pay the income tax. I don't know. That's not going to.
I think it's a little issue of fairness
in my book.
I think we should all pay one penny. But Tom, this is interesting. This is something we've had on the show before. This very same discussion, and I'm not sure whether you want to conflate a mix up a Ken Lay with the average dentist, or say you have a two dentist household, so they do real well and they're in the top bracket. If you can hate it, Ken Lay, all you like, but are you going to take that rage and translate it to hate all two couple professional households?
So you want to cut the Ken Lays out of the equation here?
Discussion like that, for just because there are bad guys who led companies the wrong way, does that mean that you punish then an entire class, the most productive component of our society? That's what you want to ask.
Amity Dean, please stand by. A lot of callers want to join this conversation. We're talking about the Bush growth package, the economic stimulus plan. It is predicated to a great degree on tax cuts. Those tax cuts are going to the investing class. What do you think? Is this the way to kickstart economic growth, which will help everyone, or is this unfair? Is that the question? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Peter's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi there. I just want to echo my great disgust with this reprehensible discussion about class warfare. It always has been a class warfare, but we're not defining the class who's aiming the war.
How do you see it, Peter?
I see it as the ultra-rich being able to, through their political persuasive power, through their contributions, being able to control the system. Corporations, you're talking about not paying their fair share. It seems to me in the Wall Street Journal, article after article in the last two or three months about corporations going to Bermuda to avoid paying taxes. And if you take a look at that type of insanity and link it to this concept of them taking on risk, my God, I have to echo the other guest who said, who of us can get three times their annual salary for failure?
But Peter, where do you see economic growth, if not in corporations, in capital applied to productive activity?
Here's the very point. The bulk of Americans are not employed by large corporations. The largest corporations funnel their jobs overseas. That's a labor statistic. Most people are employed by medium and small businesses that do not have a voice. If you really want to help to stimulate the economy, we need to give them the voice. And, as we all know, the engine of all economies is the vast middle class. And we really need, if you're going to have a stimulus package, enable them to be able to get that money. The ultra-rich already have enough vacation homes, and I don't think that that's actually going to contribute in any massive way to stock gains of anybody. If you're concerned about stock price, it's based upon purchasing things. And these people are not enough in quantity to do the job.
Peter, thanks for your call. Stephen Moore, come in here. Peter says, you hear what he says. The wealth is so concentrated that giving more wealth to this class is not going to produce extra spending. Your interpretation?
Well, the economy doesn't need more spending. Consumers have been carrying this economy now for the last year and a half. Mm-hmm. What we need is more investment. When you look at and this, Peter is exactly right. Corporations are not the backbone of the American economy. Small business is. And I want to see a multitude of new small businesses created. One of the things that we could do in that regard, for example, is cut the capital gains tax so that the people who invest in these new businesses that are going to become the future Microsofts don't have to pay this punitive tax. So there's a lot of things that we could do to regenerate growth in the small business sector. Small businesses are very overburdened by the payroll tax, and I agree with Dean Baker. We ought to cut that payroll tax rate from maybe 15% back down to 12 or 13%. And one last point about what this gentleman was talking about, he's exactly right. The corporate income tax has become so burdensome in the United States, now you actually have American companies that are moving offshore to try to get away from this high corporate income tax rate. And, you look at a perfect example of the merger between Chrysler and Daimler. It's Daimler-Chrysler now, not Chrysler-Daimler. And the reason for that, it's become a German company because the German tax code is so much more better for companies than it is in America. We should have the lowest corporate taxes, and we've become a country that now has among the highest corporate taxes.
And yet the German income distribution is so much flatter. Interesting. Emily's on the line. Welcome, Emily. You're on the air.
Thanks. Great conversation tonight, guys.
Good.
In 1991, our allies paid for a large chunk of the war in Iraq, and it looks like this time that's probably not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering what the effect of the growth package might have on counteracting the huge expense we might have to put out to pay for a future war in Iraq.
Yeah, there's a giant bill that's going to come due. Dean Baker, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's clear we're going to be looking at a big bill there, and it's going to add to the deficit. And, you know, I don't think this changes that one way or the other. I would like to just get back quickly to something Amity said, because this is a little bizarre to me that we're punishing rich people. We haven't increased taxes on them. So, and we have the corporate income tax hasn't gotten higher. It's gotten lower. We had a 50% corporate income tax 20 years ago. Now we're looking at a 35% corporate income tax. And the reason why rich people are paying a larger share, or the top 10% are paying a larger share of income taxes, we're raising a much smaller share of federal revenue through the income tax. So if we go back 30 years, we're raising about 80% of federal revenue through either the personal or corporate income tax. Now it's less than 60%. So we haven't raised taxes on rich people. We're creating this illusion. Let's try and argue from reality. They are not facing a greater burden than they did back in the 50s and 60s. They're facing a much smaller burden than during this period when the economy is growing more rapidly. Now, if you want to argue your case, let's start from reality rather than inventing a new world in which what you're saying may make sense.
But Dean, Stephen Moore has argued from the top that Americans don't resonate with that critique, that the distribution of income is not turned into a kind of fire that's boiling some other pot, that people are still on board.
Well, we'll see whether they resonate. They rarely hear it. I read the papers every day. You don't see that very often. You know, I know his candidates will have plenty of money when they run for president or run for Congress. Candidates who say this don't get money. They aren't going to go to the people making $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year and get those big campaign contributions. So they don't hear this. You know, they have to hear, you know, the arguments here, the facts. They aren't going to get that. It's very rarely put to them. I appreciate the chance tonight, by the way. Thank you.
Good to have you. And Stephen Moore, I don't want to lose Emily's question there. The impact of paying for a war on Iraq, if and when it comes, we know how big the bill can be. Might that simply offset the stimulative effect of whatever's rolled out here?
I don't think so. In fact, what I've argued to the Bush administration is that you go back to the early 80s when you had very strong economic growth. I think that's the one thing Dean was wrong about. You know, from 1982 to 1989, we had about a 4% real growth path, which was very strong. And what I would argue is, you know, if you have to fight a war against Iraq, and if we have to do this for national security and anti-terrorism reasons, that is no reason not to, at the same time, do a tax cut to keep the economy strong. This is what Reagan did in the early 80s when we did the big tax cut package to get the economy out of the what I call the mini depression of the 78 to 82 period. And then at the same time, we had a big military buildup to win the Cold War. I think Reagan proved you can cut taxes and fight for America's national security at the same time and come out of it smelling like a rose.
But Amity Schlaes, I have to admit, I'm having trouble letting go of the 80s and 90s mania about deficits. It seemed like such a gift that we got away from them in the 90s.
I'm going to hear on my answer, but I also want to answer Dean. The listeners may be confused. The reason that our caller, our guest, and I have different data is that his data includes the Social Security component and Medicare. And I was speaking specifically of the income tax, which one can argue remains an important tax. It's interesting to hear from a liberal or left perspective someone saying the payroll tax, Social Security, is a tax because FDR and generally most Democrats have always argued that it was a pension system. So to call it a tax like this is a change. To the question of the, do we have time for the question of the 80s?
Amity, stand by. I guess it may feel like a tax if you're making $6.50 an hour. We're talking about the Bush economic stimulus plan tonight. Is this package the triumph of the American rich with those scraps for the poor, or is it the way to growth? Join us, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush economic stimulus plan, the Bush growth package, tax cuts, deficits, and ideology on the way. In Washington, my guests tonight are Stephen Moore, president of the Club for Growth, joining us from Washington. Also in Washington, Dean Baker, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. And from Brooklyn, New York, Amity Schlaes, our On Point news analyst tonight. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Tax cuts mean deficits, at least for a while. Is that all right with you? What happened to deficit discipline? And what is the ideological content of this stimulus package? Are you on board? 1-800-423-TALK. We have a lot of callers who want to join us, but Amity, I want to come to you first and get back to you on deficits. Are you concerned, or is this just fine? It's what it takes.
I'm not concerned. Historically, deficits do not correlate to high interest rates, and you want to go back and look at the 80s and see a book by Larry Lindsay, named in the news this week.
Yes, we heard of it.
Which shows the growth experiment that 70% of the increase in the deficit from that period was due to bigger spending. It was not the fault of the tax cuts. It's all written there in stone in Harvard math. That the evidence is there to lay that myth to rest.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll take that for the moment. A lot of callers want to join us. Edward is on the line. Hi, Edward. You're on the air.
Yes. I'd like to respond on a matter of the tax cut. I understand the Republican plan in the area of eliminating the double tax on corporations and their dividends.
Mm-hmm. This is once for the corporation and once for the individual who receives the dividend.
What's called double tax.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what they're proposing to totally eliminate it would be fiscally irresponsible.
Why?
But I believe something could be done in that area as an incentive. And what I believe could be done would be to eliminate not the corporate side of the tax, but have a tax exemption for dividends up to what I call an equal partnership share. Say you had 100 people in a company, equal share would be 1/100th of the stock, and make that much exempt. Then you'd have something that would be tailored toward the people in the middle, because that's where the growth tends to occur in small businesses. And I think it's better to have an incentive for many people rather than just a big incentive for those at the top.
So you want to shave the dividend and make it a progressive in a way, I guess, what people pay. Is that what I'm hearing, Edward?
No, I want a full exemption on the dividend up to an equal partnership share.
Mm-hmm.
So that say, it would help those who invest in employee stock programs, for example. And for those who invest in the same company where they work, they would get an exemption up to an equal partnership share in that company.
And I guess what you're saying here is it would be fiscally irresponsible to take it all away because it costs too much revenue and may benefit too small a number of beneficiaries?
Yes, and not only that, but you'd be taking apart the tax collection system. So if you took away the corporate tax entirely, you'd find it much more difficult to collect taxes at all, and the system would start to fall apart. So I say don't eliminate that side, but the side of the double tax to eliminate is the dividend side, and do it on a fair basis. Say,
got it. We've got it, Edward. I want to get Stephen Moore's response. Stephen Moore, is taking the entire tax on dividends away a bridge too far?
Well, you know, the argument is that, we are taxing dividends twice. You said it very well, Tom. We're just explaining it in terms of the fact that it's taxed when the individual gets the dividend, and then the company has to pay income tax on it as well. And so what George W. Bush is arguing, or some in his administration, nothing is set in stone in terms of what his plan is going to be. But some are talking about giving some degree of relief so that we're not taxing those dividends twice. And the idea here is that if you took away some of the tax penalty against paying dividends, companies would start doing it again, and there would be less emphasis on capital gains. And some people say one of the reasons you've had all these corporate scandals and the cooking of the book is that there's been such a mania about increasing the book value of stocks.
Get that stock price up. Get that stock price up at whatever cost.
That's right. That's the argument, and I think it makes sense.
Mm-hmm. We hear that concern from our caller about the fiscal impact of that, but there are a lot of concerns in these calls. Shannon's calling from Bolton. Welcome, Shannon. You're on the air.
Good evening. I have a question for Amity, and then I'd be happy to take my answer off the air.
Okay, shoot.
Okay, she's been talking about how, and I came in late to the conversation, but I heard her talking about how the tax code has gotten or it used to be more progressive, or it's gotten more progressive, where the wealthiest went from paying 10% of the burden to up to 33 or 34%. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. And it seems to me that you're arguing that this is more unfair for a smaller percentage of the people to be paying a heavier burden in the tax.
What's your view, Shannon, or what's your question there?
Well, I'm a preschool teacher, and one of the definitions of fairness that we teach children, and they seem to understand this very well, is not that everybody gets the same or everybody's treated the same, but everybody gets according to their needs, and everybody is treated according to their needs. When she talks about two dentists, her hypothetical was about two professional dentists having to pay more taxes and everything, and how it's unfair for the minimum wage people not to be paying any income tax. Children can understand the idea of fair is everybody gets what they need.
But two each according to their needs seems to have been kind of vanquished in the battle over socialism, wasn't it, Shannon?
I mean, yes. To each according to their needs. I mean, that's what we talk to children about. Does that professional dentist couple, do they need that extra, do they need their money saved from the income taxes according to the
we got it. Our time's running down. I think, Amity, there it is. It's a very simple question, and straight to you.
Real simple question. Life is not nursery school. The government is not a nursery school teacher. From each according to his ability, to each according to his need, is a communist saying where the government was like a nursery school teacher. We have property rights in this country. You have the right to keep at least half of what you own. When the government starts to take towards 50%, that's confiscatory. It's not American, and it doesn't help the economy grow. So you can't pay for more nursery school classrooms. But essentially, the analogy of whether nursery school and nursery school teachers and government are alike, I think that it's you want to question it. Do you want government to be a nursery school teacher? Even if you want certain things like prescription drugs, still this larger question hangs over it.
And yet we hear the concern and the question. Dean Baker, I want to give you the mic. We've just got 30 seconds left. But where do you see this package? It is likely to pass, we are told. Where do you see it taking the country?
Well, further down the road to giving all the money we have to rich people. I should point out, when we talk about making dividends tax-free, a lot of us own stock. I own stock 401k plan. I get dividends. I'm going to be taxed on it. That will not be affected at all by this because I'm going to pay the tax when I withdraw my money from 401ks. So this is about giving money to rich people. That's what the Bush administration's proposal is all about. They own the Congress. They own the Senate. They'll probably get it through, and the rest of us should know these people are on the take, and that's the way it goes.
Well, watch this space. Much more to come from Washington. We can hope for growth. How it's distributed? Well, there'll be a big debate about that. We'll go right on. Dean Baker, thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me on.
Dean Baker is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and Stephen Moore in Washington as well. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Stephen Moore is president of the Club for Growth. Amity Schles, last word goes to you.
Well, you can see where the debate is going. It's very hot, and Social Security is going to be part of it. You can't just talk about the income tax anymore. I think that's what we got out of it tonight.
It's all going to be there. Amity, always great to have you. Thanks so much for coming on tonight. Amity Schles is senior columnist for the Financial Times and an On Point news analyst. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. This is On Point. And now we're following a developing news story tonight. Two Spanish warships intercepted a North Korean ship in the Arabian Sea, 600 miles off the Horn of Africa today. On board, they found 12 Scud missiles and missile parts hidden under bags of concrete. The ship set sail from the North Korean port of Nampo. Though it was operating under a different flag, it was believed to be bound for Yemen. U.S. military specialists have boarded the ship. The Pentagon has yet to issue a comment. On the line with me right now is Clay Moltz, Associate Director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute in Monterey, California. Good evening and welcome, Clay Moltz. What's going on tonight with this story?
Well, this is an ongoing activity, unfortunately, of the North Korean government. They have been exporting missiles, particularly Scud missiles, to the Middle East really for some time. And although this has come at a very unfortunate time, this is actually a continuation of longstanding North Korean missile export policy.
Can we speculate safely at all about what the end destination for these Scud missiles might have been?
Well, my best guess at the moment is that they were due to be received in Yemen. Yemen has purchased Scud Bs and Scud Cs in the past. And in fact, during the early 1990s, Yemen used Scud missiles during the Yemeni civil war. So they live in a rough neighborhood and they feel they need these missiles.
When was the last time Yemen used a Scud missile? I'm not sure I can picture the circumstance in which they would.
Well, there was a socialist government, as you may recall, in half of Yemen in the Cold War period, and after the Soviet breakup, they lost their aid, and they had quite a struggle with their neighbors and the rest of Yemen, and they did fight in 1994, and there were Scud missiles that were launched at the respective capitals. Eventually, the socialist forces were defeated, but the existing government still feels the need to maintain some of those Scuds.
So we're talking about internal conflict or the possibility thereof in Yemen.
That's correct. Although, again, you have to realize that in the Middle East, there are a lot of missiles around. The neighboring country of Saudi Arabia, for example, has medium-range missiles that it bought from China. And so, again, Yemen may feel that it simply needs to protect itself. The real concern would be if there was any evidence that these were going to be tipped with weapons of mass destruction. Fortunately, we don't have any evidence to that regard right now.
I guess the reason this story, this headline whips everyone's head around tonight is the possibility that these missiles might have been headed for Iraq, or that they might be portrayed as being headed for Iraq, which could amount to a cause for war in Washington, one imagines.
Sure. This would be of great concern. However, I don't think North Korea is that stupid. I think North Korea does know that if they were going to ship weapons directly to Iraq, this would cause severe problems in the relationship with the United States, which they really don't need to upset any further right now. My guess is that this was a long-standing contract that they had with the Yemenis. Obviously, they did try to conceal the weapons. They weren't advertising that they were shipping these. But nevertheless, North Korea currently is not under any formal treaty restrictions not to export missiles. They do have an agreement with the United States and with Japan not to flight test new ballistic missiles, but they don't have any agreement not to export. And the reason they export is very simple. Their economy is in shambles, and they receive probably about 25% of their export income from missile sales.
But these missiles, I'm sorry, repeat that, would you? What did you just say?
They receive about 25% estimated of their export income from missile sales.
That is astounding.
Yes, it is.
I guess it's a testament to how little North Korea has to export.
That's correct.
These missiles were found in 20 containers under 40,000 sacks of cement. If there's nothing illegal about the shipment, why were they so deeply, thoroughly concealed?
Well, I mean, North Korea is not really in the business of advertising that it's exporting these weapons. It knows that this upsets the United States, a number of other countries. But at the same time, it's going to take the risk to engage in these activities because it needs the money. And, I think it's just, unfortunately, the policies of a very desperate country.
Why Spanish warships intercepting? We read that U.S. intelligence had been tracking the vessel for a long time. Presumably, they track almost every vessel out of North Korea. Why Spanish warships intercepting and not American?
As far as I understand, there was a NATO operation in the area because of the ongoing concerns of possible ships entering into the Persian Gulf region. And it was simply a Spanish vessel that intercepted them, as far as I understand today.
What do you expect the fallout from this incident will be, Clay Moltz, in the Middle East, in the U.S., with North Korea?
Well, clearly there's going to be some negative implications on our relationship with Yemen. I mean, there were a number of incidents involving terrorists in the past several years, and we clearly don't want to see that area built up with a lot of missile systems. And so I think we're going to have a talking to with the Yemenis, although, again, they're going to say, look, we broke no laws in obtaining these weapons. On the other side, our relations with North Korea are certainly not going to improve as a result of this. The United States wants North Korea to stop these exports, and I think there's going to be increasing pressure on North Korea to do so.
But as we sit here tonight, you don't see this figuring into the standoff with Iraq.
No, I don't. I don't think these missiles were probably intended for Iraq, and I don't think they're going to be used in any conflict that would relate to Iraq.
Clay Moltz, thank you so much for joining us tonight on short notice.
Thank you.
Clay Moltz is Associate Director of the Center for Nonproliferation Studies at the Monterey Institute in Monterey, California. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sets and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR. We're funded by...